Hey, it's Dolla White, and this is the Dolla White Podcast. Now, normally I start the podcast off with some kind of corny joke, but after the verdict in the Derek Chauvin case, and considering we are still mourning the losses of Dewante Wright, 13-year-old Adam Toledo, and countless others at the hands of the people that are literally paid to protect them, I didn't think a joke would be appropriate at all. But I am glad that due to a cancellation, my guest ended up being Jamil Campbell-Gooch of Gideon's Army. Jamil is from Nashville, and in this episode, he talks a lot about Nashville, but don't let that deter you. No matter where you're from, if you like forward thinking, Jamil is your guy. If you're looking for answers, look no further than Jamil. Now, I'm sure somewhere there's an old white man that uses words like radical to describe what Jamil and Gideon's Army do, but when 13-year-olds with their hands up are being shot dead by police, maybe radical change is exactly what the fuck we need. Welcome to the Dolla White Podcast.
Pull up, Gideon. Live.
Yeah, what's up?
This is not live. It's completely recorded.
Broadcasting from one of the top recording studios in all of Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah, that's not true at all. I'm probably at home doing this.
He's been called one of the greatest thinkers of his time.
Literally no one has ever called me that. I do kind of agree with it, though.
Right here.
A 2017 recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's just a flat-out lie.
Talking politics, community, race, religion, entertainment, sports, and whatever the fuck else.
Yeah.
It's the Dolla White Podcast.
Episode 19 of the Dolla White Podcast. My guest today, Jamil Campbell-Gooch, Gideon's Army. What's good, bro?
Man, I'm all good, man. I'm just happy to be here. Excited to talk about like what Gideon's Army has going on and just give people a general update about like what's happening.
I want to start here because you broke down the school to prison pipeline to me in a way that it had never really been broken down to me. And I want as many people possible to hear the way that the school to prison pipeline works from you. Can you do that?
That's an honor and a luxury. You first to say that. There's a lot of complexities lost in this oversimplification of what it is. But essentially, if you take something that everybody does, like speed, I know I speed. And when you're speeding, a couple of things to ask yourself, did you set this speed limit? Most of us are going to say no. So that rule is already in place and we didn't have anything to do with it. If you're caught speeding, you get a ticket. If you keep getting tickets, you get your driver's license taken away. If you get caught driving on a suspended license, you might get a fine. If you can't pay your fine, you're going to end up in some sort of confinement, jails or prisons, right? That type of escalating punitive discipline also exists in our schools. I think everybody has been tardy to class. Well, if you continuously be tardy to school or class, you might get a referral or demerit, depending on what kind of school you go to. And if you keep getting that referral, usually you're going to in-school suspension, you keep going to in-school suspension, you go out of school suspension, you keep going out of school suspension, you get an expulsion. When you come back off an expulsion and when you get out of prison or jail, both populations say the same thing. They say that you're on papers. So our students are in schools right now being socialized to navigate a system of constantly being punitively harmed with suspension and expulsion. They're getting socialized and getting used to a system that constantly is harming them and not really asking them about context, like why are you showing up to school late? So when they become an adult, they might just take it on the chin because this is what they've learned to navigate, which is both an issue, both in our regular ways of how we hold adults accountable, but also in the ways that we hold our young people accountable. That is the school to prison pipeline. What that doesn't take into account, Dolla White, this comes to me because I was reading this book. Her name is Monique. It's called Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls. What's not captured in the school to prison pipeline are the other ways of confinement, house arrest. There's another form of it called the school to confinement pathway. Our black girls are experiencing a very specific type of harm when it comes to discipline and expulsion and things like that. So I just wanted to enter that as well. So when we talk about the school to prison pipeline, we're talking about escalating versions of punitive discipline and isolation that our young people are getting used to so that then when they become an adult, they might just accept it like it is every day, even if they feel like they were wrong.
So we're saying it is an indoctrination. You get used to this certain level of isolation, consequences, things of that nature. Sure. And then so when you become an adult, that level of isolation is almost natural to you. And I remember going to in-school suspension a couple times when I was a kid. The walls were cinder block. You know what I mean? It's a very almost jailish, prisonish feeling.
Right. And we're getting our young people used to navigating that type of system. So when they become adults, even if they feel like something is wrong, it might be like, okay, I'm just used to this. I know how this is going to play out. I know what type of day I'm going to have. I know how to navigate this system instead of actually trying to fight. Also, if I can mention, the way that we do school discipline or the way that we address accountability in our schools when it is punitive, it doesn't actually get to the root cause of the problem. Even in a situation where you have a student that is constantly being tardy, if no one has asked that student why, they've only continuously punished them, then what's being lost is there's a need there that is causing the actual problem, right? So as long as we're constantly handling things punitively, whether it's in our schools, in our homes, in our streets, in our courts, or anywhere, as long as we're continuously handling things in a punitive manner, we're always going to lose the actual root cause of the problem.
What kind of programs do you suggest schools implement to find out those problems and get to the root of them?
I think it's been a slow shift towards this way. So I want to say things like restorative, where we're actually centering the harm, but also things like transformative justice. Restorative really centers the harm and the impact that is happening right now and works to restore whatever relationships have been strained. Transformative justice actually looks to transform not only the two entities or the bodies or the folks that are inside of the conflict, but it also seeks to transform the greater system that that conflict is having, that is housing that conflict. Because we know certain circumstances put us in a place of conflict. And I'll give you an example. My niece goes to Hillsboro, and I was at a Hillsboro game last year, and this game was a dope game. The additional seating had been cut out due to renovations. So they had packed the gym with as many people as they can get in because it was a highly contested game. Now, that circumstance of overcrowding, too many people in one area, not enough room to spread out, usually ends in a conflict. So it's like sometimes when we're in conflict, we micro focus down on what happened. Right here, we get hyper focused, we get tunnel vision, and lose the fact that there's a whole system that has made the environment conducive for this thing to actually happen. So just to get back directly to your question, things like peace circles, where instead of going to ISS, you got a community member from the area that the students already know, trained in restorative, maximizing student voice. Students got to be able to participate in what their environment looks like. If we want to talk about in the community, things like participatory democracy, participatory budgeting, where things like the budget is created through easily engageable dynamics. People know what participatory budgeting is, right?
Right.
When we have somebody in our families unexpectedly die, and we got to get together and figure out, okay, how are we going to pay for this funeral? Okay, we're going to take a little money here. We're going to take a little money there. We're going to try to grind it out. We're going to get some paper. That's participatory democracy and budgeting. We just put together a makeshift budget talking to each other. And what I'm saying is all of our systems should look like that, whether it is our schools and how they hold each other accountable need to be based on our students actually having a conversation around accountability, what accountability look like, all the way to our city budget is $2 billion. We should have a process where all community members, everybody can participate in the allocation of their own dollars. So a lot of this harm can actually be interrupted by making sure that everyday working class people can participate in both safety, accountability, and where their dollars are being invested.
One thing I love that you guys do at Gideon's Army, you guys get together with the Nashville Black Assembly and you literally ask people in the community, what is it that you want me to go and fight for? What are your needs? And I am willing to bet no politician has ever been in that neighborhood and said, what is it that you need? What are your biggest concerns? How can we help with those biggest concerns? One, I think that's revolutionary. I don't think it should be revolutionary, but I think it is revolutionary, right? It seems like common sense. And two, what are people telling you that their biggest concerns and their biggest needs are?
The things that most people are concerned about: housing, education, public safety. And when I say public safety, I don't just mean police. I mean how to settle conflict in between neighbors, how to hold people accountable in a non-punitive way, how to actually restore our communities through conflict, because conflicts can be generative. You can build off a conflict. So those are the main three things: housing, education, and public safety. Because as you all know, gentrification is ravaging our community and displacing people at an alarming rate. Our schools are just being underinvested in, and we also know that we have no investment in alternatives to police. And so Gideon's Army is holding down a violence interruption work in North Nashville. But at this point in time, the violence that we even are experiencing in North Nashville is people that are coming from outside of North Nashville or in areas of North Nashville that we technically cannot service. What I struggle through most of the time is what would it look like if we had a full, robust violence interruption program in Nashville, right? Where we just wasn't siloed to North Nashville. What would it look like if we had a full network of violence interruption and we were able to activate those people whenever something violent happened or when it was a possibility of violence? Because the couple of things we know about policing is that we know police show up after the fact. They can't prevent things from happening. What violence interruption does is, since violence happens inside of networks, it activates those people inside of those networks to help mitigate and maintain the peace, right? Because everybody I talk to want peace. Nobody wants to die out here. With violence interruption, what ends up happening is you end up having credible messengers that are like, yo, like, how can we settle this? And actually begin to work the peace versus what we have now, which is police that just show up after the fact and do ordinance maintenance.
And I think what you also have with the violence interruption, take somebody like Hambino, for instance. Hambino, somebody that did time, came out and was like, all right, this is not the path for me. Violence interruption gave him that thing he needed to focus on. When you can look at your life and say, this is now my purpose. I think Hambino probably did that while he was incarcerated. He knew that this was going to be his purpose and his life work. Gideon's Army said, yeah, we got a place for that. You can do a lot of good in this community. And then that fulfills that purpose, right?
For sure. And fortunately, Hambino came out of that situation a better person.
Yes.
We know that prisons are not going to make us safe. Cages won't do that for us. So I do want to mention personally, it's two essential things I don't believe. I don't believe that the police can be reformed in a way that doesn't end up with Black folks being adversely affected because they're created to maintain Black people. And then two, I don't ever think prisons can be reformed in a way where they don't adversely affect Black people, because both of those institutions at their foundation, whether it is policing and its foundation with slave patrols or prisons and jails with this foundation of housing escaped slaves, both of those things are foundationally created to be adversely affecting Black people. So I don't really think that we'll ever be able to reform either one of those institutions. Right. And if we end up reforming them, we would have to reform them so much that they wouldn't look like them anymore.
I think so, that especially with prison, I think if you look at the numbers, if the goal of prison was to, I commit a crime and you put me in jail for that, and then the reason I go to jail is because I committed the crime, and while I'm in jail, I sit there and I think, and when I get out of here, I'm not going to commit a crime anymore. That's failed. The numbers show that most people that go to prison end up going back. That's not helping, quote unquote, right, crime levels, right? Like, right, the crime levels stay the same because people go into jail, right, they get out of jail, they commit another crime, they go right back into jail, and it's this big circle, and that's not actually reducing the amount of crime on the street. Right. So then you go to, all right, this has failed. We've known this has failed for how many years at this point, but nobody has come forward with a better idea, or actually you guys have come forward with a better idea, but those better ideas have not been implemented literally at all on a state federal level.
Right, for sure. And I even say, like, violence interruption is a global thing. Cure Violence is doing violence interruption across the globe. I know they got a dope one in Puerto Rico. They got another one in the Caribbean. The places that we see violence interruption in these type of community driven safety plans, the places that we see that those things go into effect are places that can't afford to throw millions, even billions of dollars into militarized police and cages. So with that being said, I think this is where it's important to talk about the Black National Assembly, because the Black National Assembly is the body to house this conversation, because we're going to literally have to talk about it before we even come up with a solution. We're going to have a dialogue about how us as community members and residents actually keep our community safe without perpetually harming folks. Like you said before, we know that these institutions are broken. We're going to have to figure out how to solve them on a community level first. And the way we're going to get to that is by doing things like the Black National Assembly or the National People's Budget Coalition, literally institutions that are housing massive conversations so that we can hopefully get on the same page.
It's crazy to me that such a failed system, and we're supposed to be a country of innovation, but we've locked up, what is it, a quarter of all people in prison right now live here. And that's not something that we should be proud of, and it's something we should look at and try to fix. And I think the other thing is, I don't think anybody grows up and says, I want to harm people when they're kids. So one thing that I love that you guys do is you're like, how can we get to you before you start going down a shitty rabbit hole? You know what I mean? And what is it that you need? And the main thing people need, I think, is opportunity, right? Opportunity, housing, healthcare, education. And we spend way too much money, like you said, on militarizing the police, and we keep pulling money out of education. We keep pulling money out of schools. We know that there are better ways to educate kids, but we don't implement them. We know that we can do better by our teachers who are fucking community heroes, right?
Right. And what trips me out, though, right, and I'm so glad that you kind of kicked that door open. What trips me out is we know that education is a deference to underground economies. We know that the longer a child stays in school and gets a quality education, the less likely they're going to get caught up in some shit that's going to harm them. But look at what we do. We take money from education and put it into police. When we know the more money we take out of education, the more likely this young person is going to get caught up in some crazy shit, literally to try to get their needs met, and more likely that they're going to end up in close proximity to police, which is wild for me. And then like last year, the mayor was asking and city council was asking everyone to tighten their belts. I think they were calling it like a crisis budget. COVID, we had a tornado, pandemic. It was like a lot going on.
Right.
Our elected officials was like, okay, everybody need to tighten their belt. So we need schools to decrease their funding. We need healthcare to decrease their funding. The only department that they gave a raise to was our police. And I think that that was telling. They told everybody where our priorities are. People are out here being harmed, dying because of gun violence. When I say gun violence, I'm looping police violence into gun violence because police violence is gun violence. And we have a credible solution. It would only take $9 million to put violence interruption across the entire city. While our police last year, they took home at least $200 million and our complete city budget is around $2 billion. It's clear that locally, our priorities are in a very set direction. And in order to shift that, we're going to have large-scale community conversations where we have some community learning and where we actually talk about getting to the root causes and actually interrupting the transmission of violence.
And I bet you that's probably the same in a lot of cities across the country, correct? Do you know of a city that puts money into violence interruption?
There's over like 20 sites of violence interruption across the country. They have one in Jacksonville, one in New York, one in Chicago, but they all look different because everybody's streets are different. There's robust violence interruptions not only across the country, but worldwide. The difference here in Nashville is that our violence interruption program is being held down by a nonprofit, a community group, which is a little problematic because I would argue is that we already pay for violence interruption via our tax dollars. But I would like to say that makes our violence interruption site very special. Also, in other areas, you usually don't have a violence interruption site that's geographically closed because just like what we're experiencing right now, we're having people that are coming from outside of our networks and doing harm in 37208. So our violence interruption shit is limited because of that lack of capital investment via our tax dollars.
So if somebody's on the south side, there's not a violence interrupter there on the south side to talk them out of going to 37208 and doing something shitty there.
Right. Because if we had a violence interruption pod in South Nashville, we could actually do some coordinating to try to prevent it from happening. With violence interruption, you can't stop everything. But what you can do is you can do as much as you possibly can to make sure both no one get caught up in the middle and that you can also make sure that you work some peace so there's no retaliation.
I know what you're saying with the city funding some violence interruption programs, but there's nobody over you saying, oh no, you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do this, you can't do this. And when you get involved in the city, maybe there is an element of that. Is that something you guys have thought through? Or
a couple of things. I do think it's like freeing to be an independent site. And I also want to say that there's going to be a piece of community safety that is always going to have to be held down outside of the system. Like in Durham, North Carolina, they have these things called harm-free zones, where it is mothers that live in the area that try to maintain the peace outside of the system. There's a group in Oakland called Anti-Police Terror that do a lot of community-based safety planning. Because since violence happens inside of networks, the state or the government is not always going to be able to come inside of those networks because the government might need to arrest you. So some of this is always going to have to be held outside of the government. In other communities, especially when it comes around participatory budgeting, when it comes to things like violence interruption, if we wanted to do it in a truly community-based way, what would happen is the local government would put the money in an independent institution, whether it be a bank or something like that. And that independent institution would then disperse the money directly to us. Or there's some mechanism like that, but it happens all the time. In New York, they have participatory budgeting where community members are led through like months of trainings around budgets. And then they have a conversation with the bank. It's several different ways to do this. But what I do want to say is that we cannot accept it for how it's done now because our local officials are in some workplaces lacking creativity. So when these solutions, or in order to solve these problems, what we need is a mass gathering of people. That's why we're doing work with the Black National Assembly. That's why we're doing work with the National People's Budget Coalition. And that's also why we're having a block party this coming up, just so that we can make sure that people, we need people to have this conversation about how to keep their community safe.
Something else you guys are working on right now is a guaranteed basic income for people in North Nashville. I think that's a revolutionary idea. It sounds like you're going to need a lot of funding to do it. So, I mean, what's the bottom line there that you guys need? What is it exactly that you guys are trying to provide? And like, what is it that you need to make that happen?
We've launched a pilot project called Moving Nashville Forward, which is going to provide a guaranteed basic income for folks living in North Nashville. This is definitely because the racial wealth gap is spreading. Also, as a part of rebuilding North Nashville, not only from the tornado, but also from the interstate being driven through it in the early 70s, which essentially demolished over 600 homes. It displaced so many community members. It dead ended over 25 streets, but it also, more importantly, caused 80% of Black businesses in North Nashville to close. If 80% of businesses closed throughout the United States, that would be considered like an economic recession. But in North Nashville, it was considered progress because it was putting an interstate through it. So we're hoping that we can provide 100 community members with a guaranteed basic income. We're very much so in the fundraising stage. A guaranteed basic income is very simply giving direct cash to people unrestricted. Now, this is not nothing new. They've been doing a guaranteed basic income in Alaska since the 70s. A guaranteed basic income across the world. There's a group called Give Directly that gives a guaranteed basic income to Kenyan farmers if it's looking like their crop yield is going to be low. They're also doing it across the country. Magnolia Mothers Trust in Jackson, they give single mothers living in public housing unrestricted cash for like 12 months. They did it in Stockton, where they gave, I think, 100 plus of their community members $500 a month over 2 years. They also done it in Gatlinburg as a response to the fire, where the Dollywood Foundation set up the My People's Fund, and they gave 900 families $10,000 over 6 months. And so what we're hoping to do, we not only want to send direct cash into North Nashville where it's needed the most, we also want to measure the impact with the hope of delivering a study so that the larger Metro Nashville government and maybe even the Tennessee legislature will look to do it on a massive scale to where we can actually improve the material conditions of the majority of people. And Stockton, who gave 100 plus community members $500 a month for 2 years, they just delivered their report of the effect. It was being done by their mayor, Michael Tubbs. They recorded that people's health improved. People had more opportunity to take risk. So that means that people were going out for better jobs. There was an increase in jobs. It went from 29% of the participants having jobs to 40% of the participants having jobs. So what the Moving Nashville Forward group is hoping to do is we're hoping to fundraise where we can get right about like 1.3 million cash on hand. That allow us to put 100 folks living in North Nashville on a guaranteed basic income for at least 12 months. Now, they're also doing something similar in Atlanta. The mayor of Atlanta, Georgia, is attempting to do something. What's different here again is that these are community members trying to fundraise in a very communal way in order to do this guaranteed basic income pilot.
Last question for you. People like you don't really run for office. Is it because you're too busy out actually doing shit and making a difference? Or is it because you don't have faith in that particular system? Y'all got some good ass ideas. You know what I'm saying? That if you guys took power, some shit might actually change. But selling your ideas to the majority of a city, I could see how that could be hard. And not only that, but fundraising to run for office is bullshit. You shouldn't have to come to the table with millions of dollars to have a shot at winning. It should be solely based upon, are your ideas better than these other people's ideas?
I do think a part of it is just like, yeah, I'm doing shit all the time.
Yeah.
I do think that's a part of it. Right now where I'm at, and I'm going to speak personally, I'm dedicated to like talking to community members. I think Fred Hampton said at one point in time, when the people have a celebrity or a leader, then the people stop doing the work that the people need to do. So I think we're in a space where, whether it's the Nashville People's Budget Coalition or the Black Nashville Assembly, where the people got some work to do. Like, we have some work to do. We got to figure out how we want our communities to be safe. We need to figure out what we actually want our tax dollars to be investing in first. But I also want to say this too. We say this all the time in the Black Nashville Assembly. We want power, not representation.
You know, I'm a huge fan of everything you guys do. I was so happy to see the Fever documentary. I was so happy to see Soledad O'Brien and BET come down. And I hope that that kind of publicity on a national level continues for you guys, because you guys deserve it.
I mean, and we live in a revolutionary time. I do think that we are in danger if we believe that we're crossing the finish line too soon. We mortgage what we got going on. If we sell it out early, then we actually will impede the actual progress that we have, which, in other words, will allow the harms that are happening right now to reform and replicate into something else. But what I'm hopeful for is that we can start involving more community members, bringing more people to the table, with the hope that we can actually go outside of North Nashville and change the greater material conditions of all of Nashville. And so what I'm hoping is that our public officials, or the people that are in control of our material conditions, also allow communities to actually have power and not just representation. Chief Drake, that's representation. Having alternatives to police that are community controlled, community sourced, and community financed, that's power.
You guys are my favorite organization in Nashville. No shade to anybody, but I mean, I love the work that you guys are doing. I love how passionate you are about everything you do as well, man. It bleeds through every time. And anytime I can help you out, you know I'm here for you.
For sure, man. Anytime, any place, man. Like, just let me know and I'm coming through.
Already. Jamil Campbell-Gooch, you can follow him at Nashville Red on IG. And whether you're in Nashville or not, follow Gideon's Army, what they're doing, because I think you're going to be blown away, even if you've never even visited Nashville before. I think you'd be blown away at the work that you guys do. Thank you.
For sure, man. Hey, man. I appreciate your time, though.
All right. As always, this episode of the Dolo White Podcast brought to you by my good friend, William Wilson of the Hammonds Group. Now, if you live here in the state of Tennessee, consider yourself a faithful listener of this here podcast, and you've yet to buy a home from William, what the fuck are you really doing? Again, I'm sorry for yelling. I'm just very, very passionate about William Wilson of the Hammonds Group and his real estate company, and I really don't know why, but he's a good realtor. He has a beautiful daughter, beautiful family, and they all need money for things like groceries and to eat. So, shit, just buy a house from William Wilson of the Hammonds Group. Call him today, 615-216-4809. Again, call my good friend William Wilson, 615-216-4809. Again, I want to thank my guest, Jamil Campbell-Gooch of Gideon's Army. Make sure you follow Gideon's Army on Instagram, at Gideon's Army United, no matter what city that you're in. It does not matter. Trust me, what they're doing can be done in your city as well. My guest next week should be Carlos Whitaker. I know I said that last week, but fingers crossed, Carlos Whitaker next week on this podcast. He's a dope individual. Check him out on the gram right now. Get a little familiar at Los Wit, LOSWHIT. Check me out as well at DoloWhite101, DoloWhite 101. Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, Clubhouse, all of them. Make sure you're following me everywhere. Definitely appreciate the love. If you want to give me a 5-star review on Apple or write a good review, I'm all for that. If you have something negative to say, just hold that in. Keep it to yourself. Back next week with a brand new episode. I'm out.